Welcome to the Closing Mark Report. It's September the 26th, 2007. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois. And a bit later in the program, Kay Whitlock of Terre Haute Grain out of Terre Haute, Indiana, will join us to talk about the cash grain market. In today's agricultural news, the president of Brazil says a WTO trade deal can be struck yet this year. $4 billion in direct and counter-cyclical payments will be issued early next month, and there is a record-setting soybean yield prediction out of South America. Dave Dickey will be along in a moment with all the day's agricultural news. We'll talk with Drew Lerner, of course, of World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City. That'll happen just after the bottom of the hour. And don't forget, we've expanded the Closing Mark Report to a full hour all this week. In the second half of the show today, we'll be joined by the Dean of the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences to talk about the land grant mission. And we'll pick up where we left off with our farm policy discussion from Focus 580 this morning. Ralph Grossi of the American Farmland Trust will join us by phone to consider the Durbin-Brown Farm Bill proposal. It all happens on this Wednesday edition of AM 580's Closing Market Report.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
In Chicago on this Wednesday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. In the wheat pit this afternoon, a nearby December contract finished the limit higher, up 30 cents at 9.17 and a quarter. March futures at 9.22 were up 30, and the May futures in Chicago for the soft red at $8.23 were 30 higher. In Kansas City, December contract finished 29 and three quarters higher at 9.03, and the hard red from Kansas City March contract at 8.98 and a quarter was up 29 and a quarter. December corn futures at $3.75, a settlement price there, three and a quarter higher. The March contract up 3 1/2 at 3.90 and three quarters. And the May corn at 3.99 1/2, three and a quarter higher. December next year at 4.16 1/2, up 2 1/4 for the day. November soybean futures, $9.90 and three quarters, up 17 and three quarters. January futures at $10.06 and one quarter, up 17 and a quarter. March contract, 10.15 1/2, up 18 and three quarters. And next year's November's at 9.56 for the beans, 20 cents higher. Bean meal futures, October contract, $7 higher at 278.40. December futures up 7.20 at 284.80. October bean oil at 38.97, up 33. December bean oil at 39.54, 35 higher. October live cattle at the Mercantile Exchange down 32.5 cents, $97.25 the settlement price. December live cattle futures at $100 and a nickel, 45 cents lower. September feeder cattle 2.5 cents higher at 115.85, and the October futures at 115.92 1/2, down 15. October lean hog futures $60.30, down 70. December contract at $62.40, it was off, or rather up a dime, and February's 55 cents higher at $67.77 1/2. From the outside markets, November crude oil $80.35, 82 cents a barrel higher. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average now is 70, well, I don't have the Dow, there it is. Dow Jones Industrial Average now at 13,847, and it is just about 70 points, or rather 64 points higher for the afternoon.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Joining us on this Wednesday afternoon to take a look at what happened in the Chicago markets is Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois. Good afternoon to you, Paul.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Shall we start with the wheat?
Sure. We understand, of course, there was export business and some small export business on the horizon. We did see wheat and the continuation of a dry weather forecast in Australia. The market made new life of contract highs today and closed limit up of 30 cents. So the market continues to focus on this very strong market. We understand that as of this morning, a bushel of wheat exported to the EU with transportation costs, it's still a dollar cheaper to buy wheat in the European Economic Community. So it does show how expensive the U.S. wheat is, particularly soft wheat, in the world market. And not only does it show the high price, but the high price of transportation getting it there even though we do have this devaluation of the U.S. dollar.
So when you look at all of that, is it just a matter that there's not enough wheat in the European Union? I assume that must be the case if they're still buying.
Well, we get the feeling that it's not so much Europe now. It's a case of other countries like Algeria, Jordan, and other people are starting to come in and buy small parcels to fill their pantry up at these higher price levels. It does cost them an enormous amount of money, but it does emphasize the idea of having a strategic stockpile of wheat, and they're very concerned about strategic cost of food policy and food prices in each individual country. So each country has a unique situation, and they are paying the price in order to get that supply.
We talked about this a little bit on Commodity Week in terms of the next crop of wheat, whether it's soft or hard or whatever type, and there are several types that are grown on the planet and around the globe that would really come on, that would be of much in terms of size, won't be until next winter. The Australian crop is reduced, probably it may or may not be reduced in size again by USDA in terms of total yield. That crop's coming in now, but it's just 22 million metric tons. And
the Argentine crop is also quite large as far as wheat's production is concerned. One interesting point is that the European Economic Community borrowed an old tool that the USDA used called a 10% set-aside, and they're basically pulled that off and is allowing their farmers as of this fall to plant another 10%, and that equates to about 12 to 15 million tons of grain production. You know, in terms that our listeners can relate to, you know, that's 600 to 700 million bushels of additional grain. So it is a big volume of grain. The upside here is that we're still in the buying mood, and the other side is that the pedal is being pushed to the floor to produce, not only here in the U.S. wheat acres, but also in Europe and probably Russia, and all wheat producing weather has to cooperate, and timing, and do we have to actually see wheat flowing from the combines in Argentina or in central Illinois to top this market out, and that's the debate and winter weather and that type of thing. But we do feel that there is an enormous amount of wheat being planted in the world.
Well, I suppose that is the question and where I was headed. Most of the wheat in the world is grown in the northern hemisphere, the bulk of it, in fact, by far. Australia and Argentina do grow wheat that they export, but their crop size isn't nearly as large as anything out of the EU-27 or North America or India or even the former Soviet republics, the CIS, where we have numbers more like 105 or 125 million metric tons as opposed to 22 million metric tons. So the question becomes then, when you get to July of next year, which is the next U.S. crop harvest month, $6.47 was the settlement price today, is that a price tag that producers need to take advantage of on fear that there will be a great bulk of wheat that will come into the marketplace from the northern hemisphere next summer?
You know, people are taking advantage of it, in my opinion, and then also another tool they're using is not only do we have the July 2008 wheat crop, it closed today at $6.47, the July 2009 crop closed at $5.94. So somewhere in there, we will have a normal supply-demand situation, and depending on which year you're the most comfortable with, you can choose your marketing tool.
All right, so tell me about the corn market for the day.
The corn market was probably, the dullest commodity besides oats on the Chicago Board of Trade. The one thing we continue to feel about corn is we do anticipate a pretty good corn crop. Some people are estimating 2 bushels more. Some people are saying 4. Do we have a threat to go to the 160.4 national average winter in 2004? The big factor here is that we think ethanol usage could be cut back as much as 300 million bushels. We also get the feeling that feed usage was pushed quite high on the last USDA supply demand. And when you add another sizable increase on this potential production, you know, we're getting awful close to that 1.8 to 2 billion bushel corn carryover number next year, which will basically take out a lot of the worries about energy demand from corn. The corn is a several advisory services are pushing corn sales, and people, when we do talk them up, talk to them on the phone, indicate that they still have a big part of the 2007 harvest yet to put to bed without any on-the-farm home storage. So it's going to be an interesting year on how this market falls into place, and I do think the one factor here that we're looking at is that in the weakness and the devaluation of the U.S. dollar has encouraged the price of corn to rally. Unlike 1972, when the Russians stole basically 800 million bushels of grain from the U.S., we haven't really seen the big export demand show up yet in the corn. That's probably anticipated, but what the difference is in 1972, they bought it, they shipped it, paid for it in gold, and this was just lowering the price level with an enormous U.S. corn crop. It's a little different equation, but it is going to be an exciting story, whatever, however it ends.
Given some of what you said and a note that I heard from your discussion with Dave Dickey this morning that you thought maybe a corn top might be coming fairly soon, I think you said that. I was in the middle of a conversation with somebody else. Do you think producers ought to be selling their crop off of the combine at this point?
Well, a person needs to take advantage of it. And one simple bit of arithmetic that we're looking at is you know, the historic basis in central Illinois is 10 under the July. And that's probably too tight for this. But as one farmer mentioned, he was lucky enough to sell $4 new crop corn, and his yield is $230 bushels to the acre. And he says, Paul, he says, that's more than I paid for the farm. And so, you know, we are looking at a situation here where it does, it's a windfall in 1972, it's a windfall in 2007, and however you as a producer play your cards is an important way to be successful this year and in the time to come, because history tells me, and I've watched this, you know, for a long time, you know, since I was in the business, started in 1971, the reward goes to the people that are able to take advantage of high prices and put the money in the pocket. You know, it's just that simple. Those are the guys that do better in the end and know how to manage are managers and also disciplined to put that money in their back pocket, because it just doesn't last forever. And this is one of those rewards that just comes, you know, every once in a while.
Well, on that note, we'll wish you a profitable afternoon.
Well, same here, Todd, and always nice talking to you.
Thanks much. And that's Paul Cooley with ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Stuart Peterson. For over 20 years, Stuart Peterson has helped farmers manage both marketing opportunities and risks through their analysis, advice, and action. Stuart Peterson's team of experts and strategic consulting approach utilize the latest technology. Stuart Peterson, confidence like never before. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
At the bottom of the hour, meteorologist Drew Lerner will join us to take a complete look at the weather forecast. Our own Ed Kieser says tonight across the two-state region in the north and the west central parts of Illinois, it'll be mostly clear. In northern and central Indiana and east central Illinois, it'll clear off as well. In the south, mostly cloudy, some scattered showers there. Lows this evening from 47 in northwestern Illinois to 62 in the far south. Dave Dickey is here now. He'll take a complete look at today's agricultural news on this expanded edition, 1 hour long, Closing Market Report.
In agricultural news, the president of Brazil says he is convinced a world trade deal can be reached in the Doha round before the end of the year. The president noted that the U.S. and the European Union in recent days are more flexible and willing to talk about agricultural subsidies and tariffs. U.S. President George Bush on Monday confirmed the U.S. is willing to cut its maximum annual subsidies to $13 to $16.4 billion a year. In return, the U.S. is asking that G20 developing countries agree to cut import tariffs on manufactured goods to levels proposed in July. USDA says about $4 billion in final 2007 direct payments will be issued to producers with base acres enrolled in the direct and countercyclical program. Checks will be issued after October 1st. The president of the Brazilian Vegetable Oils Industry Association says that nation's new crop soybean harvest could hit a record 63 to 64 million metric tons if the weather cooperates. The previous record set this crop year is estimated at 59.5 million metric tons. Monsanto has announced a new partnership with Evogene Limited to speed development of crops that would require less nitrogen fertilizer. Nitrogen-based fertilizers cost U.S. farmers about $3 billion a year. Soybean rust has made its way into the state of Illinois. The first official find of the season was confirmed at the University of Illinois in Urbana. U of I plant pathologist Carl Bradley says it was found in Massac County in deep southern Illinois. The extension specialist says it is too late in the season for the find to cause farmers concern.
Yeah, you're right. It's very late in the season. At this point in time, it basically, there's no kind of economic damage that rust can cause. All of the soybean crops, even the double crop fields that I've looked at are at that R6 growth stage. That means that it's past the point where any yield loss would be incurred.
Bradley stresses farmers in the state do not need to take any type of action to ward off a potential soybean rust infection. The wind-borne disease of the soybean cannot survive the Illinois winter and must work northward each growing season. Australian Agriculture Minister Peter McGowan today says that nation's new crop wheat could be as small as the drought-hit crop of 2006, which produced just 10 million metric tons. That's by far the most conservative estimate coming out of Australia. Just a week ago, the Australian Bureau of Agricultural and Resources Economics estimated the national wheat crop at 15.5 million metric tons. And the closed again, open again DeKalb, Illinois horse slaughtering plant is now closed again. A federal appellate court has upheld the constitutionality of an Illinois law that prohibits the slaughter of horses for human consumption and the possession, import, or export of horse meat for human consumption. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey, of course, your Director of Agricultural Programming here at the WILL radio stations. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, the host of the Closing Mark Report and Commodity Week, reminding you to stay with us for the whole hour today. In the second half hour, we'll talk with the Dean of the College of ACES here on campus about the land grant mission. And Ralph Grassi of the American Farmland Trust will join us to pick up our discussion from earlier this morning during the 10 o'clock hour of Focus 580, you might recall, that we spoke with Bob Thompson about farm policy and the farm bill. Grassi is here to go through the Durbin-Brown farm bill proposal the Senate will be taking up in the next several days. Well, up next, the record high price for wheat and an early fall harvest might give Illinois farmers a reason to put more acres of wheat in the ground. I'll have some tips for sowing a successful field of soft red winter wheat. Farmers in Illinois planted 970,000 acres of wheat last fall. 160,000 of those acres were lost to the April freeze, and most of the rest of the Illinois soft red winter wheat acres were damaged. Still, the soft red crop in the state managed a respectable 57 bushel to the acre average yield, although, as Emerson Nassiger recently wrote, that number is 10 bushels off the record yield set in 2006.
Nafziger is an extension agronomist at the University of Illinois. He figures the record high price of wheat this fall, along with the early harvest season for the corn and soybean crops, will have more Illinois farmers sowing wheat. And he says this year they'll be able to put those new wheat acres in behind either fall harvested crop. Nafziger provides some tips for planting wheat in the U of I's online pest management and crop production bulletin. He says planting wheat after soybean can be easier due to less crop residue and, in some cases, to more uniform and mellower soil conditions, and that University of Illinois research in the western part of the state has shown a consistent yield advantage of 2 to 4 bushels where wheat follows soybean compared to wheat following corn. Well, this difference might be less in southern Illinois, he writes, especially where lower corn yields mean less crop residue and some carryover nutrients, primarily nitrogen. The agronomist also cautions farmers to make sure that herbicides applied to the previous crop and the rate and timing of application allow wheat to be planted this fall. On fertilizer for wheat, he says wheat responds more than corn or soybeans to phosphorus, which should be applied if soil test levels are not high. If P levels are known to be high, it's possible to skip a P application for at least a year. Wheat is less responsive to potassium, otherwise known as K, than corn or soybeans. So the K application probably is unnecessary if soil test levels have been adequate. Now, the wheat crop benefits from a small amount of nitrogen at the planting time. If wheat follows a corn crop that produced a less-than-average yield in a dry growing season, there will often be enough carryover in to meet the needs of the wheat crop in the fall. Otherwise, 20 to 30 pounds of nitrogen per acre should be applied before planting. And finally, the U of I's Emerson Nafziger says the decision of whether to till the soil before planting wheat depends on the evenness of the soil surface, distribution of residue, and the ability of the drill to place the seed to a uniform depth in the soil. That last consideration, the ability to place the seed to a uniform depth of about 1 to 1.25 inches, is the most important. If it is not possible to do this without tillage, then tillage might be necessary. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
I'm Denise Perry, local host of All Things Considered. A day's pledges in 1 hour. Power Hour, 7 a.m., October 11th.
I'm Todd Gleason. This is the Closing Market Report. We're joined now to take a look at the cash grain market by Kay Whitlock of Terre Haute Grain out of Terre Haute, Indiana. Good afternoon to you, Kay.
Good afternoon to you, Todd.
Harvest season moving along rapidly there in your part of the world?
Well, until yesterday and today, yes. We had combines rolling everywhere. They were just kind of had a good start in the bean fields, a lot of corn out, especially on the sand ground. But, yeah, we've come to an abrupt halt here, and they should be back in corn probably tomorrow, but it may be this weekend or next week before we get back into beans.
Give you at the elevator a chance to catch up.
We need a chance to catch up. The thing about it is, though, at elevators on rainy days, that's when the farmers do all their bookwork. So we have been swamped in here while they are at home doing their paperwork kicked back.
Well, I bet the outside help was appreciative of the chance to catch up. How about that?
That's true. They were.
All right. And then how's basis holding up under the onslaught of grain?
Believe it or not, it's really holding up pretty well and even improving a little bit as far as trade values are concerned. Here again, the October-November seems to be improving a little bit more than spot trains, although they have improved somewhat. Beans, it just depends on regions, Todd. Some levels are better and some are worse, but basically it's just kind of holding its own. It's not improving as much as corn, though, at this time.
And what are your bids for the day?
Our cash bids today are corn is $3.36, cash beans $9.26, and wheat for next year is $5.62.
We appreciate you being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks much. And that's Kay Whitlock of Terre Haute Grain out of Terre Haute, Indiana, joins us here on the Closing Market Report each and every Wednesday. Remember, this is a full hour-long Closing Market Report. Another half hour yet to come up. At the beginning of that half hour, we'll talk with Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City. That's just about 2 minutes away. Right now, time for your regional newscast.
With this look at AM 580 News, I'm Tom Rogers. Governor Rob Blagojevich says his meeting with legislative leaders this morning was the most constructive and productive they've had all year. But the governor says there's still work to do. The state leaders met in Chicago to discuss the Capitol bill passed by the Senate earlier this month. When Monticello Teachers Union representatives meet next Monday with school board negotiators, the threat of a strike will loom overhead. Yesterday, teachers voted to authorize a strike in as early as 10 days if bargainers recommend it. They've been without a contract since the end of July. A judge has cleared one of the teens charged in a gun incident that led authorities to lock down Pontiac Township High School. The boy was charged as a juvenile with weapons possession, but Associate Judge Robert Travers freed him yesterday. The teen had been in custody since the August 28th incident. Prosecutors contend 16-year-old Sean Sullivan brought the guns to school to sell to another student, 15-year-old Martin Huerta Jr. The judge also ruled that the boy charged as a juvenile saw the guns but wasn't part of the planned sale. Another student told police about the guns. Two University of Illinois professors say a new state law meant to reduce the number of illegal immigrants in the workplace may backfire. The law keeps employers from taking part in an online federal program that verifies legal status for employees. The law keeps the prohibition in place until the Department of Homeland Security can process requests within 3 days. The U.S. government is suing to overturn the law. Economics professor Barry Chiswick says if employers can't use the system, they might resort to inadvertent discrimination. The Transportation Security Administration says the object that sparked an evacuation at the Indianapolis International Airport this morning was material used to train officers. The TSA says inert training explosives were inadvertently left overnight at the security checkpoint leading to one concourse. A volunteer firefighter leaves southern Illinois tomorrow to spend 6 months serving at a fire station in Antarctica. Macanda Township firefighter Mitch Fallett will be one of a few dozen firefighters stationed at McMurdo Fire Station, and he says he's looking forward to the adventure. I'm Tom Rogers, AM 580 News.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report. I'm Todd Gleason. Joining us now for a look at the agricultural weather is Drew Lerner. He's a senior agricultural meteorologist at World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Good afternoon to you, Drew.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Hey, when I got up this morning, it was kind of cold and wet, relatively speaking, here in the Midwest. How long will that stay with us?
Well, it's pretty much gone already. We're going to fall back into a little late summer weather for a little while here. We are going to warm up in the next couple of days. It'll probably be a little bit on the crisp side for yet another 24 hours, but that's about it. There's not a lot of precipitation in the pipeline, a few stray showers for the region. The next frontal system of significance will come across the region probably on Saturday late. Actually, for the western Corn Belt and eastern areas, we'll probably see it on Sunday. The storm system will bring a hefty amount of rainfall to the eastern Dakotas and Minnesota, but when the frontal system comes through the Midwest, it's going to be a fairly big wimp, I think. Our rainfall potentials across areas east of the Mississippi River will be very low, probably running up to a quarter of an inch and not a great deal more than that. And our coverage will probably only be about maybe 30% of the eastern belt. So not a lot of precipitation coming in for the next week. We are looking for temperatures to rebound, though, and we will see some warmer weather occur here Thursday, Friday, maybe Saturday, and then that frontal system will come through. We'll fall back a little bit on our temperatures again and warm up again, all over again. The pattern seems to be pretty much stuck in a rut for the next 10 days. We're going to see this pattern prevail. Our temperatures will bounce around from the 70s into the 80s and back again and for highs, and our lows will never be any cooler than probably the upper 40s. And that would be a big reach. Mostly we'll be in the 50s, I think.
I suppose farmers can take those temps as long as there's not a lot of rainfall that comes with them as they change from one spectrum to the other.
That's right, and there's not a lot of precipitation in the pipeline right now. I think we have another frontal system that will come across the region real briefly during the about Tuesday or Wednesday of next week. That event is expected to be even weaker than the one over the weekend. So I don't think we're going to see a lot of precipitation on the east side of the Mississippi River for a good full week, maybe as much as 10 days. The potential for greater rains will increase as we get into the second week of the two-week outlook.
When I last checked, Brazil was in the middle of its planting progress for soybeans, and in the middle to the northeastern side of that country, it's hot. It's really hot.
It has been quite hot. We're actually seeing a little bit of a breakdown in the heat for right now. I don't think it's going to last terribly long, but we are losing most of those temperatures that are in the middle and upper 90s through the lower 100s. But the precipitation is not there today. Most of that region is experiencing a general lack of moisture.
You can go ahead and stop.
And the bottom line is that the region needs a substantial amount of precipitation before planting and dry land fields can really move along. some of the early planting soybean fields are have not been planted, and we'll probably see that stay on hold here for the next week to maybe 10 days. I don't expect a lot of precipitation to fall across those northern areas, and like you said, it will stay hot probably for a big part of that period of time. Maybe conditions will start to improve as we get into the second week of October.
And then let's wrap up with the Chinese growing conditions, actually, as they're in their season and are in the midst of harvest for corn and soybeans.
That's right, and the weather has been ideal in China for the past few days as far as offering an opportunity for significant drying and good field progress, but that is going to come to a roaring halt now, at least in east-central China, because of a persistent rain pattern that's likely to develop. It's actually forming today, and we will see rain frequently in east-central sections of the country through the first part of next week. Now, when we go into the second second week of the two-week forecast, some of that shower activity will continue, but not quite as heavily. The northeast provinces, where over half of the soybean crop comes from, will actually be dry through a big part of this forecast period. So it's kind of a 50-50 deal there, where some of the crops will be able to be harvested, others will be subjected to a lot of rain.
Thanks much, Drew.
Have a great day.
You too. Drew Lerner is a senior agricultural meteorologist at World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. That's not the end of the closing market report for this Wednesday afternoon. 25 minutes yet to go. We'll talk shortly with the dean of the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences, Bob Easter.
You can learn more about careers in broadcasting that go beyond on-air performance at the Illinois Broadcasters Association's Free Job and Career Fair, Friday, September 28th at Illinois State University. Companies large and small from throughout Illinois will be there to discuss education needed for careers in broadcasting. The Illinois Broadcasters Association's Free Job and Career Fair is Friday, September 28th from 2 to 4 in the Bone Student Center at Illinois State University in Normal.
Programs on WILL are made possible with support from Sinfonia de Camera, presenting music with a Latin twist with Fiestas and Fandangos on Thursday, October 4th at 7:30 p.m. at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. The program will include works of guest composer Roberto Sierra and feature James Carter on saxophone and marks the world premiere of Sierra's Piano Concerto.
You're listening to an expanded edition of the Closing Mark Report. This is WILL Urbana, AM 580. We're joined in studio this afternoon by the Dean of the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences, Bob Easter. Good afternoon to you, Bob. We appreciate you being with us.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Todd. Thank you.
Let's start by talking just a bit about what the dean's role is at an educational institution, at a land-grant institution in particular, like the University of Illinois or Purdue or Iowa or one of the land-grants across the nation, Cornell.
That's a really interesting question and one that I think about from time to time, and I'm not sure I've ever quite figured out the exact answer. But in a real sense, the dean has an administrative role, but in our case, I'm assisted by associate dean responsible for an extension, one responsible for our research portfolio, and another responsible for our academic programs. The dean is in a sense responsible for understanding the landscape and the issues that exist in the food and agricultural system, and developing the strategy and the vision for how the college will become engaged in addressing those, along with the associate deans. And that is an ever-changing and very dynamic world.
You talked about three associate deans, and those line up with the land-grant mission, research, outreach, and education.
Right. It might be useful to talk about this. The academic programs are a product of the Land-Grant Act that occurred in 1862 when the federal government gave each state land as a grant to sell and then use to build universities like Illinois. 1887, the Congress realized that if you have an academic program, you also need to have new and current information to teach in the classroom. The Hatch Act was passed that created a federal-state partnership around an agricultural experiment station, which today we call the Office of Research. And that's the second mission of our college, to do research broadly in the food and agricultural system. And that includes families and communities, because that's part of the system as well. And then the third element in 1914, if you have all this good research on campus, how do you extend it to the citizens of the state? The Smith-Lever Act created extension, cooperative extension, as we call it, or in Illinois, as we call it, University of Illinois extension, which is to extend information from the research laboratories on campus to all citizens of the state.
Now, Dean Easter, in a couple of moments, Ralph Grassi of the American Farmland Trust will join us to talk a little bit about farm policy and what the Senate is looking at in terms of the next revision of the 2007 Farm Bill next week. You probably have some ideas about the dollars that we are going to be looking at in the Senate side for research and education and land-grant institutions. Financially, how tough is it for a land-grant university for the College of Aces to operate, and where do the dollars come from?
The dollars come from many places, but federal sources are a major component of that. Our salary dollars come from the state government and also from tuition that our students pay. But the federal legislation around the Farm Bill creates within USDA various funding lines. One continues to fund that Hatch Act, which supports the experiment station research. The other continues to fund the Smith Lever. So I always look at these proposed bills to see those words that are still in there. What has been growing, and we're very excited about, is competitive funding, the National Research Initiative. And our faculty are very competitive. And if you put dollars on the table at the federal level, we'll be there to compete for those dollars for specific research programs.
I think you were wanting to say hello to Ralph Grassi before you have to get out. And you'll be with us for a couple of more minutes yet this afternoon. You have a dean's meeting this afternoon?
That's correct. In fact, I'm meeting with my three associate deans to talk about some of the issues that we need to make decisions around.
I believe Ralph is on the line with us. Are you in Washington, D.C. this afternoon, Ralph? Is that where we called you today?
I'm sitting here looking out on Connecticut Avenue.
Well, the dean said he wanted to say hi and maybe hear from you what the numbers look like for research and education and land-grant facilities.
Oh, good afternoon, Dean. Enjoyed working with you on the Chicago Council project.
Well, we had it all figured out for the Farm Bill a year ago. Now things keep changing on us.
And it's changing almost by the hour now. And I have to say that the financial situation, you know, does not look good. It is very tight. And as you know, the Senate Ag Committee has asked the Finance Committee to come up with quite a lot of money to take care of some of the needs that have been identified and funded over on the House side. But it's not clear that the Finance Committee has yet identified the sources of that money, and they really don't have much time left. The clock's ticking.
I think Bob Thompson told us this morning, is that figure $10 billion and that Max Baucus is willing to come up with it, but he wants to tell everybody how to spend it? Is that right?
Well, the number that's been thrown around is $10 billion, although we've been hearing late as this morning, we heard $6 to $10 billion. So there seem to be people hedging their comments a bit now. And yes, it's very clear that Mr. Baucus wants a major say in how the money is going to be spent. So that does not work well for Mr. Harkin, who would like to have the money to allocate to, of course, some of his priorities.
Those who are listening can join us on our conversation this afternoon. We've got a couple of numbers that you can call into. If you're local, you can call us at 333-9455. We'll talk about Farm Bill and the land-grant mission. The dean needs to get to his dean meeting pretty shortly, but maybe you can stay with us for a couple of more minutes. If you're out of the local area, you can call us at 800-222-9455. So it's 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 if you'd like to talk to the dean of the College of Aces here on campus, Bob Easter, or to Ralph Grassi of the American Farmland Trust. Ralph, the American Farmland Trust has been awfully active in the Farm Bill debate. You in particular, along with the dean and even Bob Thompson, served on the Chicago Council and put together some programs that were presented as Farm Bill. I know that the American Farmland Trust, I believe, has signed on with the Senator Brown-Durbin Farm Bill proposal. Can you tell me more about that?
Sure. The Durbin-Brown Senate Bill, Senate Bill 1872, is the proposal to replace the current countercyclical programs with a revenue-based program. I think you've probably had plenty of discussion about revenue-based programs, but this is the result of a lot of work over the last 3 or 4 years. National corn growers, even the American Soybean Association, have all done quite a bit of analysis, and then we did our own independent work on what's the best safety net. And we came to an early conclusion that a revenue-based safety net was far superior to a price-based safety net, which is, of course, what we have now, because you could incorporate the yield factor so that if we had widespread drought or other incidents that caused yield to drop, we'd be able to accommodate that in the safety net. And so we're quite convinced that a revenue-based safety net is the right risk management tool for agriculture for the future. And Mr. Durbin and Mr. Brown have seized on that, and they have proposed a state-based revenue counter-cyclical program that is kind of a compromise of the various proposals that were put out there. The National Corn Growers wanted a county-based program. We wanted a national program, as did the Bush administration. The American Farm Bureau proposed a state-based program. And we think that Mr. Durbin and Mr. Brown have captured the strengths of all the recommendations quite well, and we think it has it's a very viable alternative.
What did the numbers for the land-grant institutions and those acts that the dean talked about look like in that bill?
Well, the Durbin-Brown bill would not deal at all with the research.
It only deals with the commodity title.
One commodity title, yes. And it would be revenue neutral. So it wouldn't cost any more than the current baseline that's allocated for the programs. But it would deliver more in a more timely fashion than the current programs do, because it would deliver when you actually needed the money.
Dean Easter, one final question before you go. For the stakeholders, for the College of ACES, the Agricultural College here on campus, what is it that ACES does for them in terms of farm policy and this farm bill debate?
We have a very robust Department of Agriculture and Consumer Economics, and one of the efforts that is always ongoing is analysis of various programs and their implications for the stakeholder community. We also have an interest in policy. Bob Thompson, that you referred to a few minutes ago, holds the Gardner Chair in Agricultural Policy. And we communicate with stakeholders through a variety of obviously documents, traditional meetings, and programs on the radio like this. But FarmDoc, which is on the web, has become a major tool for us for communicating around these issues with the agricultural community. And if you go to our college website, www.aces.uiuc.edu, you'll find a link right there to FarmDoc. It's worth taking a look at. And almost as quickly as proposals are up, there will be some analysis that will be put on that website.
Well, we appreciate you taking the time to be with us this afternoon. Dean Bob Easter of the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences. In a moment, we'll continue our conversation with Ralph Grassi of the American Farmland Trust. If you'd like to join that conversation, please give us a call at 217-333-9455 or 800-222-9455.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Carl Spine Institute, treating the region's most difficult neck and back problems. Information at 217-383-6555.
When you're a jet all the way from your first cigarette to your last dying day.
When West Side Story hit Broadway 50 years ago, it was not an instant hit.
A musical, in the first act of which ends with two corpses on the stage as the curtain comes down, was really reprehensible to many people at that time.
The significance of West Side Story, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 WILL Urbana.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report. I'm Todd Gleason. We're joined this afternoon by Ralph Grassi of the American Farmland Trust to talk about ag policy, and in particular, the Durbin-Brown Senate bill for the Farm Bill proposal deals with the commodity titles. Ralph, could you explain to us how that particular bill would pay producers and in what times they might expect a payment?
Sure. The way it would work is that each farmer would have a calculated gross revenue per acre, and your payment would be based on that gross revenue per acre. You take a statewide average, but this would all be done in a very timely way. As soon as the harvest season is done, there will be a calculation in every state that grows your particular crop, for example, corn in the Midwest. That
harvest time revenue, that is yield times price, that gives you your total revenue per acre, would be compared to the guaranteed revenue, which was established before the crop is planted in February or March of each year. And the farmer would almost immediately get a payment for the difference if their revenue was below the target revenue. And, of course, if it was above the target revenue, there wouldn't be a payment because there wouldn't be a need for it. But whenever there was a loss, there would be a loss immediately. One of the advantages, there would be a payment immediately. One of the advantages of that is that it would also cover things that historically have had to be covered by ad hoc disaster assistance, particularly effects of drought, for example. Revenue insurance would cover that, and your payment would come right at the end of the season, as opposed to the current system where sometimes you have to wait 2 or 3 years for Congress to act on a ad hoc disaster bill. So we think that this would certainly make more timely payments to farmers who have suffered a drop in revenue.
And this would cover corn and soybeans, wheat, and all the rest of the commodity crops that are covered at this time?
Yes, as proposed, it would cover all of the commodity crops. And just for your farmer viewers out there, the revenue calculation is quite simple. Obviously, it's just price times yield. And in the Durbin-Brown bill, they use a long-term yield trend. But it's real price, 3 years, last 3 years, average insurance price is used for the price component. So it's fairly straightforward. It's quite similar to some of the current revenue insurance packages that farmers already have available.
Would there be something that requires producers to take advantage of an RMA or a crop insurance program in order to be in the program or not?
No, there would be no requirement at all. It would be the farmer's option. And since the federal government would be covering losses, average losses at the state level, then it would be the farmer's responsibility to add any additional individual coverage they think would be necessary. So that would be a choice up to the individual farmer. We would expect that almost every farmer would still take out some crop insurance. But our calculations and the work done by Dr. Bruce Babcock and Dr. Carl Zuloff suggest that this would probably bring the price of insurance, the premiums, down considerably, because the federal government would be taking the risk of a widespread revenue drop, so the private insurance companies could then insure just for individual risk, and that should cost a lot less.
Tell me how it differs or how well, I guess I'd like to know how well it's being accepted on the Hill. Who else is in the play at this point? Has Chambliss got something that they're pushing? What else do we have on the Hill that might be in the Senate next week when they go through these discussions?
It's not clear what else we have available on the Hill just yet. We know that Mr. Conrad and Mr. Chambliss have been working on some recommendations that they hope to propose in the Ag Committee when they have a markup. Of course, Mr. Harkin has been working very hard all summer in trying to put together a chairman's mark that they could move to markup on next week. Mr. Harkin has been very supportive of a revenue-based countercyclical program. There actually is quite a bit of support for the concept. I think when you go from concept to the details is where there are differences of opinion about how to go forward with it. But as you know, the House bill has an optional revenue program, and we're suggesting that the Senate take the additional step and make this a mandatory program. It saves money, it saves crop insurance premiums, it gives farmers a better safety net, and mitigates the need for widespread disaster assistance.
Will there be losers across the nation in this farm bill? Not in the Durbin-Brown bill, but in general, do you think that, for instance, the producers of the so-called white commodities, rice and milk and cotton, will lose during this farm bill debate?
Well, I think that's a wide-open question at this point. You know, agriculture is having a terrific year, and so if there are adjustments, it's a little easier to swallow those adjustments in a year like this than in a tough year. But it does not appear there's going to be significant change, for example, in the dairy program or in the sugar programs. There'll be some adjustments on the margins. Big question that was put on the table just in the last few days is the future of direct payments. Mr. Harkin has suggested that they reduce direct payments in order to pay for some of the other priorities. We hear that now, I don't have confirmation on this, but that Mr. Conrad is also suggesting some reduction in direct payments. We've seen some paperwork to that effect. So that's a question. Just a few weeks ago, most folks thought direct payments were safe. I think now they clearly are on the table for discussion and are at some considerable risk going forward.
You mentioned the sugar programs. How can it be that that program is safe when it appears that on January 1st, when the North American Free Trade Agreement kicks in its final phase, that may cost the U.S. taxpayer a huge amount of dollars?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm sorry. I'm chuckling a little bit, but people have been asking that type of question for a long time, and we scratch our heads wondering why we don't see some movement there. As you know, the House has a provision for the federal government to buy excess sugar and sell it to ethanol plants. That has some favor in the Senate as well. And it could very well be that if there's any change at all, that it will be to try to move excess sugar toward ethanol plants. But it does not appear that the Farm Bill is really grappling with this looming movement of sugar across the border from Mexico. So I don't have a very good answer for you on that one.
Just a couple of minutes left. Do you think the Senate can get it done?
Well, of course they can. It won't be easy. But it can be done. They can get a farm bill to the floor in late October or early November, and it can go to conference before the end of the year. We can have a farm bill. It's going to take some real leadership on the part of the Senate leadership, Mr. Reid, Mr. Durbin, Mr. Schumer, and, of course, Chairman Harkin, Baucus, and Mr. Conrad. We're going to have to come together, and everybody's going to have to give a little bit, the nutrition community, the conservation community, the bioenergy community, and certainly the farm commodity programs are all going to have to give a little bit to get a bill done in this fiscal atmosphere.
Do you think it's too late for citizen action at this point? Has the farm bill in general been taken up by the vested interest and citizens really don't have much of a say?
No, it's never too late for citizen action. It's always impressive how your elected politicians respond to a phone call from back home. They're much more responsive to phone calls from out in the field than they are from phone calls from K Street. And so I'd encourage people to make that call and encourage your senators to move toward a more reform-minded 21st century farm policy.
Ralph,
you know, this is a good time to make change. If we're going to make change, it's a whole lot better to make it during good times than bad times.
Indeed it is. Ralph, we appreciate you being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Ralph Grassi is with the American Farmland Trust, joined us from his office in Washington, D.C. You've been listening to an expanded edition of the Closing Market Report here on WILL Urbana, AM 580. My name's Todd Gleason. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. At the top of the hour, we'll join the world. And we bid you a good afternoon. If you happen to be in the combine or in the farm field this afternoon, you're about halfway through, I suspect, with corn harvest. Be very careful out there and take some time to rest up.
Support for the world comes from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.